It is Monday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, 71 people die in a plane crash near Moscow. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson calls for credible elections in Egypt. And a prominent women's activist continues to fight for equal rights on stage. It's all ahead. Russian investigators are examining possible causes to Sunday's passenger plane crash that left all 71 people on board an Antonov 148 twin-engine jet dead shortly after takeoff from a Moscow airport. Russia's transport minister, Maxim Sokolov, said the first task of the special organized commission will be to organize logistics, adding it is far too early to draw any conclusions about the loss of the Saratov Airlines plane. Hundreds of people and dozens of vehicles have been deployed to collect debris, human remains, and search for the flight and cockpit data recorders, the so-called black boxes. Todd Curtis is founder of the website airsafe.com. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty images he has seen lead him to believe the aircraft broke apart shortly after takeoff.
What was shown was essentially fairly small pieces of wreckage widely scattered, which implies to me that since there's no central crash location with a lot of wreckage, that this aircraft very likely broke up in midair.
What would cause that?
There are any number of things that could cause this sort of thing to happen. In fact, in 2011, another aircraft, the same model, was in a flight test mode where it went into a high-speed situation and lost control and literally shook apart in midair. And it, too, was an in-flight breakup. As it turns out, other reports indicate that this aircraft went into a fairly aggressive descent, roughly twice the rate that you would see in a normal aircraft descent, shortly before it disappeared from radar. So it implies that perhaps this airplane was in a rather high-speed situation for that phase of flight.
This is a fairly new aircraft manufactured just 8 years ago.
The Antonov 148 was a fairly short production run. There were less than 50 of these aircraft made, and in fact, the production, to the best of my knowledge, ceased in 2017. And there are only a handful of operators around the world that use this model aircraft.
There was a suggestion by one consultant that the disappearance of the aircraft could indicate the jet's transponder lost power. What would be the importance of that?
Well, I think it would be entirely too early to speculate as to why the aircraft may have not communicated with the outside world or may have dropped off of radar. And again, this is very early in the investigation. I'm sure the Russian authorities are fully capable of figuring out exactly the sequence of events that happened from the time this aircraft took off to the time it was lost to radar.
According to one report, the last large-scale crash in Russia occurred back on Christmas Day 2016 when a Tupolev 154 operated by the Russian Defense Ministry on its way to Syria crashed into the Black Sea. All 92 people on board were killed. How would you rate Russia's aviation safety record?
Russia has a very impressive history in aviation development, from airliners to spaceships and such. In short, the Russian and before that the Soviet system developed in parallel to what was happening in Europe and America and elsewhere. So there are some essential differences in how the earlier Soviet-era jets and aircraft were designed and some differences in operation. But that said, in the modern era, especially in the almost 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the over 25 years since the ending of the Soviet Union, most of the major Russian airlines are actually flying the same jets and the same turboprops you would see in Europe and North America. And their operational behavior is very similar to what you see in larger operators in the West. The jet that crashed was from one of the smaller operators, and it was operating domestically. And this is going to be part of the investigation. Were there some things about domestic flight operations for this airline that would have been fundamentally different from what you would see in an international operation? And did those differences in any way lead to this crash?
That's Todd Curtis of airsafe.com. Well, tragically, the crash came just weeks after two groups, the Dutch aviation consultancy 270 and the Aviation Safety Network, proclaimed 2017 the safest year for aviation ever, with no commercial passenger jet fatalities. It is time now for social media. VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman, among others, are tweeting a report that internet users in Uzbekistan have been reporting being able to visit websites that have for many years been blocked. Among the news websites once again made available were those of the BBC, Voice of America, Moscow-based Fergana News Agency, and Eurasianet. The websites for Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have also been unblocked. Perhaps most remarkably, the website run by the foreign-based People's Movement of Uzbekistan opposition group can also now be viewed inside the country without a proxy. Well, also trending, today is Abraham Lincoln's birthday. The 16th president of the United States was born in 1809 and was assassinated in 1865. Larry Smith tweets, on this day in 1809, Abraham Lincoln, born in Kentucky. His birthday became a national holiday in 1892, and today's the anniversary of the cornerstone being laid at the Lincoln Memorial in 1915. Michael tweets, today is the birthday of the greatest president in American history, Abraham Lincoln. Nobody could have brought the country back together and eliminated the evils of slavery like he did. And that's a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A new wave of international conflict complicates the war in Syria. South Africa's political crisis deepens over embattled President Jacob Zuma. Ethiopia will drop charges against top dissident Bekele Gerba. And Ukraine opposition leader has been kidnapped and deported to Poland, according to reports. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's raining outside and your joints and back are hurting, so there's got to be a connection between the two, right? Well, not really. Researchers at the Harvard Medical School have released a new study that suggests there is no link between rainy days and joint or back pain. The Harvard researchers made their findings after sifting through and analyzing insurance records of more than 11 million doctor visits by older Americans between 2008 and 2012, along with daily rainfall data gathered by thousands of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration weather stations. Study leader Anupam Jena, a professor of healthcare policy at Harvard, says that no matter how they looked at the data, they didn't see any connection between rainfall and physician visits for joint or back pain. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Barack and Michelle Obama unveil their portraits at the National Portrait Gallery. Wading into a scenario of mounting regional tensions, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson began a five-nation visit to the Middle East in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, where he called for next month's presidential elections to be transparent and credible. The top U.S. diplomat met Monday with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry and touched on topics including economic and military cooperation and the fight against terrorism. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Secretary Tillerson held a joint news conference with Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry at the old Foreign Ministry compound, highlighting topics of concern to both countries, including the fight against terrorism and U.S. concerns about Egypt's presidential elections. Both men stressed that they had agreed not to interfere in each other's internal affairs. Tillerson noted that both he and Shoukry had discussed the promotion and protection of human rights and the vital role of civil society in Egypt, along with issues related to the upcoming Egyptian presidential election in March, in which incumbent President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is running largely unopposed.
The United States, as it does in all countries, supports a transparent and credible electoral process, and all citizens being given the right and the opportunity to participate freely and fairly.
When asked about alleged political oppression in Egypt, Foreign Minister Shoukry responded that the political process takes a long time to evolve, but that Egyptians have expressed their views at the ballot box, along with changing their government several times during the past 7 years.
Development in the social and political field is an evolutionary process. I think over the last 11 years, the Egyptian people have shown their commitment and the determination and their ability to change their course and to indicate their dissatisfaction. If they deemed that they were dissatisfied, they have been able to change two governments in the last 7 years, and they have undertaken legislative elections and know how to protect their rights and to advocate.
Secretary Tillerson stressed that both the U.S. and Egypt were determined to jointly pursue the fight against terrorism, and that Egypt was a key member of the U.S.-led coalition against the so-called Islamic State group.
We agreed that we would continue our close cooperation on counterterrorism measures, including our joint commitment to the defeat of ISIS. And Egypt has been a very important member of the Defeat ISIS coalition from the beginning. Egypt deals with the threats of ISIS themselves and are dealing with it certainly currently in the Sinai.
Egypt began a countrywide anti-terrorism operation dubbed Sinai 2018 on Friday and has been launching airstrikes against terrorist targets, including arms caches, as well as attempting to disrupt arms supply routes from Libya and Gaza. In response to an Arab journalist's question about U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of the State of Israel, Tillerson insisted that the U.S. remain committed to the peace process and that several key points of the president's decision were being misinterpreted.
In the announcement President Trump made regarding Jerusalem, he also made two very important points as well, one of which was he was not advocating for any change to the status quo as to oversight of the holy sites, recognizing the proper role of existing authorities. And the second is that the final boundaries of Jerusalem are yet to be determined, and that those will be decided among the parties.
When asked about Egypt's relations with North Korea, Foreign Minister Shoukry pointed out that many U.S. allies also have diplomatic ties with Pyongyang, but went on to stress that economic and other ties were minimal.
Egypt has had normal diplomatic ties with North Korea, as does many Western and NATO members, and those ties are, in terms of the relationship, limited to representation, and there is almost no existing economic or other areas of cooperation.
Secretary Tillerson added that the U.S. was still evaluating eventual diplomatic negotiations with North Korea, but pointed out that it's up to Pyongyang to decide when they're ready to engage with the U.S. in a sincere and meaningful way, since they know what has to be on the table for discussions. Tillerson met with President al-Sisi at the Al-Ittihadiyya Presidential Palace before heading to the airport and continuing his tour that will include stops in Kuwait, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Well, here in Washington, the National Portrait Gallery has unveiled portraits of former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama. Barack Obama's portrait was painted by Kehinde Wiley, an artist best known for his vibrant, large-scale paintings of African Americans. For Michelle Obama's portrait, the gallery commissioned Baltimore-based artist Amy Sherald, first prize winner of the Portrait Gallery's 2016 Outwin Buchiever Portrait Competition. The former president said this was a new experience for him and his wife.
Like Michelle, I have never had a portrait done of myself. I mean, the hope poster by Shep was cool, but I didn't sit for it. Nobody in my family tree, as far as I can tell, had a portrait done.
Obama said artist Wiley is noted for highlighting subjects that generally are not readily noticed by the public.
People who helped to build this country, people who helped to build this capital, people who to this day are making sure that this place is clean at night and serving food and taking out the garbage and doing all the other stuff that makes this country work, so often out of sight and out of mind.
The paintings were unveiled Monday at the gallery, and that's the gallery's part of the Smithsonian Group of Museums. The gallery has a complete collection of presidential portraits. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Author, actress, and activist Eve Ensler is having a busy winter. Her one-woman show, In the Body of the World, based on her memoir about surviving uterine cancer, just opened off-Broadway. And V-Day, the global activist movement she started to end violence against women and girls, is celebrating its 20th anniversary this month. Jeff London reports.
Eve Ensler has dedicated her life and work to women's issues around the world, and theater director Diane Paulus wanted to collaborate with her.
I mean, if there's anyone who walks the walk, it's Eve Ensler.
Paulus had read Ensler's memoir and saw in it the basis of a one-woman show.
I thought it was some of her best writing because it was signature Eve. Philosophy, politics, feminism, all told through humor and her point of view, which she does not shy away from. But it was so deeply personal.
So Paulus arranged to meet Eve Ensler in her Manhattan loft.
She came over and I read the book to her. It took 5 hours. We took a couple of pee breaks and that was it. Yeah.
They began an intense process to translate that book into a play. In it, Ensler describes walking the walk. She spent years visiting war zones and was helping victims of rape and torture in the Congo.
I think what really struck me about the Congo was the kind of synergistic cauldron of colonialism, capitalism, racism, insane misogyny. You know, all of those violences kind of being enacted on the bodies of women.
Ensler was creating a women's leadership community and sanctuary for survivors of gender violence there called City of Joy when her own life got upended.
And it's almost impossible building something in the middle of a war zone. You don't have roads, you don't have electricity, you don't have... It was madness. And as that's all in chaos, I got diagnosed with stage 3-4 uterine cancer. The alchemy of it all was just, you know, change or die.
So how'd I get it? Was it tofu? I ate a lot of tofu. Was it failing at marriage twice? Was it worry every single day for 56 years that I wasn't good enough?
In the Body of the World toggles between the harrowing journey Ensler took to fight the cancer, her own painful family history, and her connection to women and nature in the outside world. Ensler says her own experiences with rape and abuse caused her to mentally disconnect from her body.
And so I think my whole life, not only have I been trying to get back into my body, but I've been really working to find ways to support women coming back into their bodies. And cancer did the trick, as well as building City of Joy, because those two things together, You know, we were building a place where women could come back into their bodies.
Women's bodies are the central focus of Ensler's signature work, The Vagina Monologues. Originally written as a celebration of vaginas and femininity, Ensler says the purpose of the piece changed to a movement to stop violence against women. 20 years ago, on February 14th, the first V-Day was held when productions of the play in professional theaters, colleges, and even living rooms raised millions of dollars towards women's causes. For the anniversary, 3,000 performances are scheduled.
I'm so emotional right now coming up on the 20th anniversary. You know, when I think 20 years ago how hard it was to say the word vagina, you know, how crazy everybody thought it was, you know, and then to see how women, amazing women across the world, across this country, took this play, brought it into their communities, were brave enough to put it on.
And all because Eve Ensler has been brave enough to walk the walk as an advocate for women's issues for decades. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As economic and political conditions continue to deteriorate in Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro has turned his sights on another target, national Catholic leaders who have raised their voices against the misery the corrupt Maduro government has visited on the Venezuelan people. Maduro has called for an investigation into clergymen who have been critical of the government, claiming they may be guilty of a crime under a law passed in November by the illegitimate National Constituent Assembly, made up almost exclusively of supporters of President Maduro. Among other measures, the so-called constitutional law against hatred, for peaceful coexistence, and tolerance punishes purveyors of messages of purported hate in broadcast and social media with penalties of up to 20 years in prison, and members of political organizations who spread supposed hate must be expelled. Human Rights Watch described the law as a clear threat to freedom of expression. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights said it could generate a strong intimidation effect incompatible with a democratic society. Using this law as a weapon against Venezuela's religious leaders is Maduro's latest attempt to silence any opposition to his regime. Maduro reportedly referred to Catholic clerics, whom local media said included Bishops Victor Hugo Basabe of San Felipe and Antonio Lopez Castillo of Barquisimeto, as devils in cassocks. He also said the Catholic Church in Venezuela was full of evil, poison, hatred, perversion, and slander. In 2017, Venezuelan bishops criticized the dismantling of constitutional order in the country, and they recently condemned the hastily announced elections Maduro insists must take place in April. U.S. Representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Nikki Haley, denounced Maduro's call for a criminal investigation of the two Catholic bishops who spoke out against hunger and corruption under the so-called anti-hate law. In a statement, she noted that Maduro's reign of violence, repression, corruption, and bankruptcy continues to punish the Venezuelan people. By targeting religious leaders who promote peace and provide hope for believers, the regime continues to show that it cares only for preserving its own power and cares nothing about the basic human rights and welfare of its citizens. We continue, Ambassador Haley said, to stand strongly with the Venezuelan people in their battle to restore their democracy in the face of a brutal dictator.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.